From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We follow the cocaine pipeline on today's Fresh Air with investigative reporter Paul Eddy, co-author of The Cocaine Wars. Jeanette Winterson's mother raised her to be a Pentecostal preacher, but when Jeanette fell in love with an older woman, the church gave up on her and she gave up on it. Winterson's first novel was autobiographical. Today she talks about her life and reads from her new novel, The Passion. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Ike Turner, whose career in rock and roll began long before he met Tina. And book critic John Leonard reviews Crimson Joy, Robert Parker's latest Spencer detective novel. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Journalist Paul Eddy spent the last few years researching the Colombian cocaine cartel and the pipeline to Miami. He concludes that the Reagan administration may have fought the wrong war in Latin America. While it obsessively focused on stopping the spread of communism, drug traffickers were subverting much of Latin America. Paul Eddy says that the White House rhetoric about the war on drugs was never matched by sufficient funds. Eddy is the co-author of The Cocaine Wars. He began his cocaine research as part of the investigative insight team of the Sunday Times of London. He was the team's editor for 4 years. Since 1985, he and his two co-authors have lived in Miami, and they traveled through Central and South America researching the cocaine wars. I spoke to him from station KQED in San Francisco. I asked Paul Eddy to explain his statement that perhaps the United States fought the wrong war, fighting communism instead of drugs.
Well, it's not necessarily the wrong war, but the problem is the obsession that particularly this administration, but also to a degree Congress, has had with the fight against the threat of communism in Latin America has gone to such an extent that I think they've often ignored the very real threat posed by drug traffickers. Because whilst the communists, at least so far, are still some distance away, the drug traffickers are in this country. They are poisoning this country's blood system.
To what extent do you think Latin America is now controlled by drug traffickers?
I think there are various countries that are in appalling trouble. Colombia, I think, has been brought almost to its knees by traffickers. And there are large areas of that country where the traffickers have more respect, more power, more authority, and are certainly more feared than the central government in Bogota. I have a lot of sympathy for that government. I think that there are people within it, both elected and officials, who have tried extremely hard to stand up against trafficking, with precious little result and often at appalling risk to themselves. The Colombians say, and I think with some justice, that this war on drugs in their country is not a war of words, and thousands of people have been killed.
Let's talk about the Colombia cartel and what the United States is up against. First of all, you say that the cartel established control over the city and over authorities through fear. Explain what some of their tactics have been in manipulating.
Well, quite often the manipulation is based on bribery rather than fear. They will buy people in the sense that they provide employment, they provide some form of social welfare, they will pay money to corrupt officials. But those they can't coerce and bribe, they will intimidate by threatening them. And if those threats are ignored and those people continue to stand up against them, then by very violent action. Often kidnapping, very often assassination. They've killed one justice minister, one attorney general, half the justices of the Supreme Court, 50 or 60 other judges, senior police officers, army officers. There's a saying in Colombia, which is you can be rich or you can be dead. And the problem we have in dealing with these people is that they mean it. They don't make empty threats. If you stand in their way, if you seriously threaten them, they will eliminate you.
So are you suggesting that the part of the judiciary system and the government that isn't already bought by the drug traffickers is totally intimidated by them?
Yes, and it's also overwhelmed. The average investigative magistrate in Colombia has 3,000 to 5,000 unsolved homicides on his docket, and no possibility of dealing with a fraction of those. And by the time people have come to trial, if indeed they do come to trial, it's 3 or 4 years down the track. The likelihood of witnesses turning up is almost zero. The Colombian justice system is a joke, and that's not my expression. It's a quotation from people who work within it.
Let's talk about the origins of the Colombia cartel. The biggest people within the cartel have been the Ochoa family.
Yes.
Who are they, and how do they get started in the drug business?
The Ochoas are a family of landowners and ranchers, and they breed horses. And in the post-Vietnam period in the United States, among those who witnessed the growing tolerance for drugs in this country, as well as a growing demand, was Jorge Ochoa. Jorge is the middle son. There are three sons. He's now aged 39. And he saw that there was an enormous and growing market for illegal drugs in this country. Simultaneously, in Brazil, because of, first of all, the decline in tin prices, and secondly, the collapse of the cotton price, in Bolivia, what they essentially did was to substitute cotton with coca, a mass planting operation that took place in 1976. And within two or three years of that, we saw an enormous increase in supplies of coca, which is what cocaine is made of. And Ochoa was among those who realized that on the one hand there was this enormous and growing market, on the other hand, enormous and growing supply. And he went back to Colombia and, among others, decided to put the two together. Later on, the importance of Ochoa's role is that he, among others, but he's the principal one, decided that what had been rival and disparate gangs of traffickers, more often than not fighting each other, that they had common cause and common interest, and that it would be better served if they were to cooperate, to collaborate. And he and a man called Pablo Escobar, in around about 1981, formed in the city of Medellin, Colombia's second biggest city from where they both come, formed what they called Medellin and Company, which has now become known to us as the Medellin Cartel, certainly the most powerful and certainly the most influential trafficking organization that exists today. Into their partnership, they later took a man called Gonzalo Rodriguez Gacha from Bogota. And between them, these three, I like to refer to them as a sort of Boeing aircraft corporation of the drug world, in the sense that as Boeing employs hundreds, if not thousands, of subcontractors to make the bits and pieces that go into one of their airplanes, so the cartel employ hundreds, if not thousands, of people who get involved in various stages of the process of making and distributing cocaine. And they are known in their own country as the holders of the quota. These are the three men who decide which groups get how much business, and therefore they are extremely powerful.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Paul Eddy, who's the co-author of the new book, The Cocaine Wars. Now, once these individuals banded together and formed a cartel, how did it change the drug trade in Colombia? You describe it as almost going from these little kitchen-sized operations to these huge complexes manufacturing cocaine out of coca.
Yes, I mean, it became essentially much more sophisticated. The cartel is an integrated, vertically organized, highly sophisticated, ruthless corporation. And one of the best examples of that we've seen was their construction of a clandestine laboratory in a remote area of Colombia, which they called Tranquilandia. It was on an island 6.5 square miles and contained the most sophisticated cocaine production laboratory, sleeping quarters, all the accoutrements that they needed. It was guarded by guerrillas, with whom the cartel has a loose affiliation, and was set up with all kinds of escape routes and things like that. And when Tranquilandia was eventually raided by the police, they found among an enormous amount of equipment some 14 tons of cocaine. Now, 14 tons is what we used to estimate to be the entire world annual production. And here in this one complex, there was 14 tons, and it was pushed into the river by the authorities. And my point is that there was so much cocaine available by then, so much of it was reaching the United States, that in America we didn't even notice. Nothing happened to the street price of cocaine.
This might be asking for the real obvious, but how did Miami become the American end of the cocaine pipeline?
Two reasons. Geographic, obviously, one of them, because it faces Colombia. It's the front door of America. It's the most convenient entry point from that part of the world. I think secondly because South Florida, and particularly Miami, has a very large Hispanic population, and I think the cartel feel more comfortable dealing with Hispanics rather than gringos, who they don't altogether trust.
Now, I want to ask you about the Drug Enforcement Agency's attempts to deal with the Colombian cartel. But first, I want to ask you about a couple of other of the main characters in this drug pipeline story. Let me ask you about Luis Garcia, who's also known as Kojak, because he shaves his head and looks slightly like Telly Savalas. Now, you say that he introduced the drug trade to the Bahamas.
I'm not sure he introduced it, but he perfected it. He went out and bought a nation. Kojak was 47 years old when he became a smuggler, and prior to that he led a fairly respectable life, raised his children, paid his taxes, that kind of thing. But at 47 he saw in Miami the type of people who were getting involved in the smuggling business, that's bringing it in from transshipment points into the United States, principally Florida. And he thought if these guys could do it, he could do it, and probably a great deal better. And Kojak, realizing that the Bahamas was only 50 miles off the coast, went over there and bought everybody he needed to. There was almost nobody he didn't or wouldn't pay. He had the head of the Bahamian drug strike force on his payroll, so that whenever this man went out to conduct a raid, he would first of all call Kojak to tell him he was coming. And as a result of this, Kojak was able to buy himself virtual immunity. He operated from several Bahamian islands. For 4 years, he brought drugs into the United States like a shuttle service. He didn't lose one load. Not one of his people was arrested. He didn't kill anybody, and neither were any of his people killed. He was never indicted nor prosecuted. Indeed, he wasn't even questioned. And at the end of 4 years, he was able to go to the Drug Enforcement Administration, who knew well of him. I mean, knew a lot about him, and tell them that he was retiring and they didn't have to bother about him anymore. They explained it wasn't quite as easy as that, and Kojak was eventually persuaded to work with the DEA and to help them in some undercover operations. He was essentially our guide to this world. He took us around, showed us how it worked, introduced us to the people involved in it, and without him we certainly wouldn't have got anywhere as near as close as we did to the trafficking industry.
What was it like traveling around with him?
Great fun. Occasionally scary. I remember particularly when a contract was placed on his life, and the DEA wanted him to get out of town, and he refused to leave because he had a dinner date with me. I
kind of puts you on the spot, doesn't it?
I did my best to persuade him. You know, we could have dinner any day. Let's go. But he wouldn't. He stayed, and he insisted after dinner and going to his own house and sleeping in his own bed, and I went with him. And it was a scene sort of out of Miami Vice. I had no idea what I was doing, but fortunately nothing happened. He was a remarkable man. I don't admire for one second what he did, but I did admire him. He was very brave, very honest in a strange way. He introduced to the Bahamas what he calls true communism, which is, if I make a buck, you make a buck. And that was kind of his philosophy in life. He made millions upon millions of dollars, but he gave away millions upon millions of dollars.
Why do you think he retired?
He retired principally because he became bored with the company he was obliged to keep. By and large, small-time drug traffickers, the people who bring the stuff in and who then distributed it, are not very interesting people. They don't have a lot of conversation, and far too many of them use the stuff, which limits even further their conversation. But secondly, and I think more seriously, he saw the damage that it was doing to his family, members of his family who were involved in his business. Either their greed for money was becoming so great, or, unfortunately, some of them were using the product. And he had a cousin who was violently murdered, another one who was heading that way, and a couple who were addicted. And I think he came to regret it. He was one of these people who thought marijuana was, you know, nothing very serious, and if people wanted to smoke it, that was fine. And he didn't have a great moral standpoint about cocaine, but as he saw the damage that cocaine was doing, he became, I think his view changed a lot, and I think at the end he was quite sorry about what he'd done and went out of his way to try and put it right by helping the DEA.
Well, now, what's his status now?
Unfortunately, he died. He died of a heart attack. Just as this book was coming to an end, we were trying to persuade the wife of Carlos Leda, perhaps the most notorious trafficker so far convicted in the United States. We were trying to persuade his wife to talk to us, and she'd agreed to do so, and Kojak went to New York to collect her for us and unfortunately suffered a heart attack and died.
So when you used to travel with him, you called him Kojak?
No, he didn't like being called Kojak, except by the people he used to work with.
Right.
No, I always called him Lewis.
I found this very interesting that several of the people who were or are very big in cocaine trafficking had counterparts in the film and television world and used their counterparts' names. You know, there was Kojak, there's Little Clint, named
yeah.
after Clint Eastwood. I find that kind of amusing, I think.
Well, you know, it's a very lonely life being a drug trafficker, because you can't very well go home and say, had a bad day on the drug boat today, dear. You can't talk to your neighbours very much about it. And so they do end up talking to each other a lot. And because they are also paranoid, first of all, they walk around, they're always armed. And secondly, they talk in these sort of strange elliptical language, so that just in case anybody's overhearing it, it doesn't make any sense. And they call each other by nicknames. And some of them have a bewildering variety of nicknames. I know people who have sort of 14 or 15 different names, and you never know what to call them because you're not sure what name they're using today.
Let me just ask you briefly what Kojak's connection was to the Colombian cartel. Kojak, again, having bought off a Bahamian island to use as a point of operation.
Kojak started by smuggling marijuana from Colombia, graduated eventually to smuggling cocaine, and just shortly before his retirement, brought in for the Medellin cartel what was then probably the largest single shipment of cocaine. By today's standards, it was tiny, but in those days, 350 kilos, which is what he brought in, was quite a lot. And he was a subcontractor. He was paid per pound or per kilo, or whatever it was he brought in, and he then paid his people according to a scale of fees and netted the profit. And the profit, for example, on the last load he brought in for the cartel was $1.8 million.
Okay, I want to talk with you about the war against drugs that's been waged by the Reagan administration, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is journalist Paul Eddy, co-author of the new book, The Cocaine Wars, which is about the cocaine trafficking pipeline from Colombia to Miami. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
British journalist Paul Eddy is my guest, author of the new book, The Cocaine Wars. Now, the Reagan administration has declared a war on drugs, but you think that they haven't fought that war very well. Let's look at some of the strategies that have been used in the United States and see why you think that they failed. One of the strategies was to try to get Peru and Bolivia to stop growing coca, thinking there would be no raw material for Colombia to manufacture cocaine from and that would dry up cocaine. Why do you think that was ill-advised, that was doomed to fail?
Well, the people of the Andes have been growing coca since 2000 BC. It's part of their culture. It's part of their religion. It's a good luck charm. The Incas regarded it as divine. They smoke it. They drink it in tea. They chew it. And frankly, they don't take very kindly to foreigners coming along, telling them that the oldest known stimulant to man, which is what coca is something they shouldn't grow. And why don't they grow something healthy, you know, like tobacco? So first of all, you have that great resistance to that. Now, of course, they grow vastly more than they need for domestic consumption. And the reason they do that is quite straightforward. You can find farmers in parts of the Chaper Valley and elsewhere in those regions where the entire family's total income for the year might, if they are lucky, be $200. Now, by growing just enough coca to make 1 kilo of cocaine, they can make $500. They can almost treble their income, just growing a little bit more of what they grow anyway. And when you think of the number of people who are doing this, any idea that, that any government, certainly of a government like Bolivia or Peru, can go out there and somehow stop these people doing that. It's just ludicrous.
Well, the Reagan administration knows, I think, a good deal now of who the kingpins are in the cocaine pipeline, who the main traffickers are. What are some of the obstacles they're up against in actually getting these guys?
Well, first of all, locating them. George Achara has been located twice, once in Spain, where he was arrested, and once in Colombia. Now, what happened in Spain was that the United States spent almost 2 years trying to get him extradited to this country and failed. The reason they failed is because most of the evidence against him that was specifically presented to the Spanish courts also concerned Nicaragua. The American accusation being that the Sandinista government was involved in drug trafficking to the United States. And the Spanish have a very different view about Nicaragua to the United States, and frankly thought that this was all cooked up, and that what the United States was doing was trying to bash the Sandinistas rather than extradite a drug trafficker. And because of that Nicaraguan factor, Ochoa was allowed to go, not to the United States, but to Colombia, where, to nobody's surprise, he was released almost immediately. Now, when he was arrested in Colombia at the end of last year, the United States believed that there was a possibility that the Colombians would extradite him to the United States. That seemed to me a forlorn hope from day one, and indeed what happened was that eventually his two brothers, George's two brothers, and Pablo Escobar, his partner, went and had a word with a judge in Medellin. I do not know what passed between them, but I do know the result, which was the judge ordered Ochoa's release from prison. There's a great hoo-ha in Colombia, the government launched inquiries and all this kind of thing, but by that time Ochoa is gone. And the influence of the cartel is now so widespread, they are involved in so many countries, that he has so many safe havens. I think it's extremely difficult to find him. Even if we did, and let me say that the United States government has a $500,000 reward on the table for the arrest of George Ochoa. If that were to happen, I think it would rather be like arresting Henry Ford and hoping that would bring an end to automobile accidents. It's too late. There is now beneath Ochoa and beneath Escobar a whole generation of people who've been brought up with the experience that the cartel has given them, who are actually, I suspect, waiting for Ochoa to move over, and indeed some of them even maybe trying to nudge him aside.
Were you surprised to find out about the... about an ally like Noriega of Panama being involved in drug trafficking himself?
No, I wasn't. And I don't believe that anybody who's looked at this topic since 1983 or 1984 could have been surprised. In fact, I think you'd have to have been both blind and deaf not to know there were serious, consistent and persistent allegations that Noriega was benefiting from drug trafficking and facilitating it. That my surprise was that they really believed that he was an enemy against communism, that he was this guy who was, you know, helping us stop the threat from Cuba and Nicaragua, whereas in fact, as we now know, he was dealing with both sides all along. The guy is a straightforward drug trafficker, has been for a long time. He's not the only one. He's not alone by any means.
What do you think the Reagan administration should do to effectively wage war on cocaine?
I don't come here with any simple answers, I'm afraid. And all the answers that I've heard debated are either impossible or on their own they're not going to work. I mean, legalization, I don't think, stands a chance of being approved, either politically or in public opinion. Interdiction, this great myth that we can somehow seal our borders and stop the stuff coming in, is just silly. It doesn't work. It seems to me the only way to do it is to somehow try and reduce demand. And that is the one area where I see a few glimmers of hope. There are surveys showing that, for example, the class of 87 high school students were less inclined to experiment with cocaine than the class of 86 or 85 or 84. And if that trend might be maintained through drug education and the Just Say No campaigns, all this kind of thing, then eventually we might see the demand for cocaine decline. What bothers me about these surveys is that their optimism ignores the fact that the people who are now most at risk from the epidemic of cocaine are those who use crack cocaine, and they tend to be the people who've dropped out of high school anyway. Crack cocaine, because it's available in smaller units and therefore at a price which more people can afford, at least initially, has crossed the borders in our society. It's gone down into those communities where they're not using drugs to enhance their lives. They're using drugs because they don't have a life, they don't have jobs, they don't have hope.
What are you going to be watching for as this story continues?
I think you will see increasing violence from crime associated with the use of crack cocaine. There's only two ways that most people can afford to support a crack habit once they acquire it. One is by becoming dealers themselves, which means they go out seeking new customers, therefore spreading it. The second way is through crime, through robberies, muggings, breakings, and that kind of thing. We're also beginning to see turf battles in ghettos as people fight for street corners where the crack can be sold. And what has alarmed me as I've been travelling around the country this month is we're not just talking about Miami, New York, and Washington, D.C., and San Francisco. We're now talking about relatively small, quiet places that we thought were immune from this kind of thing. St. Paul, Minnesota, for example, has an appalling crack problem that has led to violence, to young people being killed. In St. Paul a couple of weeks ago, there were men, crack dealers, driving through the ghetto who were encouraging their children as to the possibilities of this trade by throwing money out of the car windows. We see it in Arlington, Virginia. They're having to treble the size of their jail because of drug-related crime. More than half of the murders committed in America last year were drug-related. That's going to build, and I think people are very frightened about that.
We only have a minute left, but I'm curious about how you got onto this story, since you're a British journalist and it's really such an American story.
Well, one of my co-authors is Colombian, and he'd seen and was living in Colombia, and he'd seen the growing power of the cartel. I'd been to the Bahamas to do an investigation there and saw what was happening in that society and how corrupt it had become. And it just seemed so obvious that all of this was bound to have an impact, that what was happening elsewhere, this enormous increase in supply and this utter ruthlessness of this organization, must be impacting on America. And so we decided to come and see for ourselves.
You've been living in Miami. Will you continue to live there now that your book is completed?
No. No, I have left Miami.
You've left it, and you're going back to England?
Eventually.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
My guest has been Paul Eddy. His new book is titled The Cocaine Wars. It's published by Norton. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with poet Sharon Olds. Her book, The Dead and the Living, won the National Book Critics Circle Award and was the Lamont Poetry Selection of the Academy of American Poets in 1984. She'll read some poems from her new book. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Jeanette Winterson was a teenaged fundamentalist preacher, but she had to give that up when she came out. Now Winterson is the author of two critically acclaimed novels. Coming up, she discusses her life and reads from her new novel, The Passion. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Ike Turner, Tina Turner's ex, and the man some say made the first rock and roll record ever. And book critic John Leonard reviews Crimson Joy. It's detective writer Robert Parker's latest chapter in the continuing adventures of Spencer and Hawk. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The Soviet government is an inflexible system which has lost touch with the public. That was the message Mikhail Gorbachev gave to 5,000 officials attending a special Communist Party conference in Moscow today. NPR's Ann Cooper has details.
The Soviet leader proposed a long list of changes in the political system, starting with the national legislature. He suggested a new Congress of People's Deputies that would select the country's lawmakers, as well as a new president with authority over foreign and domestic policy. He endorsed expansion of multi-candidate elections for local government councils and new limits on the term served by elected officials. The councils and the restructured legislature would gain some of the power over economic and social life that's now monopolized by the Communist Party. But Gorbachev said legislators would still be guided by the party, which would not give up its authority over national policy. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The Justice Department today filed suit to put the Teamsters Union under government supervision, charging that organized crime controls the 1.7 million member union. The government complaint filed in federal court in New York asks for the removal of Teamsters President Jackie Presser and other top officials and seeks the appointment of a government trustee. The government contends that a pattern of racketeering, which allegedly includes 20 murders, has deprived union members of their rights. At a news conference in Montreal today, a Teamsters lawyer called the federal suit totally un-American and denied the union is influenced by organized crime. Attorney General Edwin Meese today blamed Congress for the bribery fraud scandal at the Pentagon. At a news conference, Meese said that congressional requirements designed to prevent fraud are too time-consuming, leading contractors to the conclusion that, quote, we've got to get ours now. He said the procurement process is so complex that the Pentagon is not at fault for the alleged billions of dollars in waste and reported bribes taken by top military officials in exchange for favorable treatment to defense contractors. In a solemn ceremony at the Vatican today, Pope John Paul II named 24 new cardinals from 18 different countries, Sylvia Pagioli reports.
These appointments brought the number of cardinals to a record 160, and more than half the cardinals eligible to elect a pope have been named by John Paul. The two new U.S. cardinals are John Hickey of Washington and Edmund Shoka of Detroit. Both churchmen follow the pope's firm stance on doctrine. Since the last batch of cardinals was named 3 years ago, the Europeans have been in a minority, and now the balance of power has moved even further away from the West. Africa has 17 cardinals and Asia 11, a sign of John Paul's attention for the Third World, where the majority of the world's 850 million Catholics now live. For National Public Radio, this is Sylvia Poggioli in Rome.
Stock prices closed higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 22 points to close at 2130.87. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington. The U.S. military attaché in Greece was killed today in the explosion of a remote-controlled car bomb. A White House spokesman called the incident a senseless act of brutality. Navy Captain William Nordine was killed when a car bomb detonated as he drove by on his way to work. Nordine's body was found 45 feet away from the blast. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, but Greek officials suspect the left-wing guerrilla group November 17, which has claimed responsibility for 11 assassinations since 1975. French railway officials today said yesterday's train crash in Paris killed 59 people and injured 32 others. It was the worst such accident in the city's history. Lynn Terry has more.
Railway officials said about 100 rescue workers were still clearing the wreckage from Paris's Gare de Lyon train station, where the accident occurred last night at rush hour. A runaway train raced into the station at about 40 miles an hour and plowed into the back of a stationary train.
This is Fresh Air. Lots of people today think of Ike Turner as the man who used to be married to Tina. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says even before that union, Ike had made a name as one of the early scouts of rock and roll talent.
A couple of years ago, Tina Turner published her autobiography, I, Tina, which confirmed the rumors that had been going around the music business about her husband, Ike. He took cocaine, fooled around with the Ikettes, their backup singers, and beat Tina. Since then, Ike Turner has lived under a cloud, and while I don't condone his behavior with Tina in any way, I do think it's important that we remember that before he even met her, his place in rock and roll history was safe. Ike Turner was born in 1931 in Clarksdale, the center of the Mississippi Delta, and began playing the piano at the age of 6 after hearing Boogie Woogie master Pinetop Perkins on the radio. Before he was out of high school, Ike's band, the Top Hatters, was playing dances throughout the area, and Ike had his own radio show on which he presented a lot of local blues talent. In 1950, he took a smaller version of the Top Hatters to Memphis to record, and there he found Sam Phillips' recording studio. The song they cut, Rockin' 88, is considered by some to be the first rock and roll record ever.
You've heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along.
Ike played the piano, and the record appeared on Chess as being by Jackie Brenston and the Delta Cats. By mid-1951, it had been at the top of the rhythm and blues charts for nearly 4 months, and Brenston and the band took off for Chicago, stranding Ike in Memphis. Now, Ike Turner was never a particularly modest guy, and he told Sam Phillips that he knew where there were lots more great blues performers. And Sam, in turn, told Lester Beharie, a Memphis businessman whose two brothers, Jules and Saul, owned Modern Records, L.A.'s most successful blues and jazz label. They headed to Memphis to meet this young man and brought with them one of the very first portable tape recorders. With Ike as talent scout, the Beharies took off in their car and drove all over the South, making recordings like Whole Heap of Mama by Brother Bell, recorded in January 1952 at the Casablanca Club in Greenville, Mississippi. It wasn't high fidelity, but it was what the Beharies were looking for. Back in Memphis, Ike set the tape recorder up at the YMCA and in his friend Tuff Green's living room and produced a phenomenal group of recordings by Roscoe Gordon, Junior Parker, Johnny Ace, and B.B. King.
Woke up this morning, my baby's gone. Woke up this morning, my baby's gone. I ain't had no loving since my baby been gone. Got nobody.
My Baby's Gone has more of Ike's piano than B.B.'s guitar, doesn't it? And Ike took advantage of the situation to record under the name Loverboy.
Why did you leave me? Why did you have to go? Why did you leave me? Why did you have to go? Why did you leave me? No, it would hurt me so.
Records like Why Did You Leave Me made it clear that Ike did better when other people sang his songs. A young lady would be ideal, and he had one close to hand, his wife, Bonnie.
They say love is a gamble, and I really do believe it's true. They say love is a gamble, and I really do believe it's true. 'cause I tried so long that it's getting me through and through.
Love is a Gamble was recorded at Tough Green's house, but Bonnie usually played piano in Ike's band, the Kings of Rhythm. They toured, scouted talent, and played shows whenever Ike wasn't making records in Memphis. Mid-50s, Ike moved to St. Louis and then to Cincinnati. Along the way, he lost Bonnie and met and married Annie Mae Bullock, whom he renamed Tina. He also put aside the piano and played more and more guitar, becoming one of the best blues guitarists of all time in the process. But from about 1960 on, all of his successes came with Tina, and both Ike and the Kings of Rhythm faded into the background. His early stuff is next to impossible to find, but it's well worth looking for if you care about the early days of rock and roll.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. The chapter names in Jeanette Winterson's first novel, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, are the same as those in the Old Testament. The novel is Winterson's autobiographical account of her severe upbringing in a Pentecostal family in the north of England, where the walls were decorated with mission maps, and everyone spoke of right and wrong with Old Testament certainty. The novel won England's Whitbread Prize for the best first novel. Winterson's new novel, The Passion, is set in France, Russia, and Venice during the Napoleonic Wars. Jeanette Winterson left the church after she fell in love with a woman. I asked her to describe her family and its commitment to religion.
It's perhaps hard to imagine, but this was a family that was entirely centered around God. We went to church every night for one reason or another, either the prayer meeting or the sisterhood meeting, you know, or the regular church service. And at home, people were always in and out, trying to find out what the missionaries were doing in foreign parts. And that was my mother's job. She was the missionary secretary. And she was always worried that most of them were being killed or eaten.
How did you start to preach?
I just got up there on a box. You know, the boxes got smaller as I got bigger. And I did it. I mean, it never seemed a strange thing to do because my parents had adopted me because they wanted me to be a missionary. And in the meantime, they wanted me to preach the word. So I knew that that was my job. And because I had the Bible read to me every day and because, you know, I've got a good memory, I guess I just knew how to do it.
What kind of sermons would you preach?
Oh, real hellfire and damnation ones. You know, there's no messing about with the fundamentalist, is there? You go straight to hell if you're not saved by Jesus.
Was it considered unusual for a girl to be a preacher?
No, it wasn't. But that was because my mother, being a very strong woman, had decided that I was marked out as special and that when she'd gone to the orphanage to find herself a baby, God had said, "This is the one, take her home." So it didn't really matter what gender I was at that stage. It was simply that I was doing the Lord's will. Later on, of course, it mattered enormously what gender I was.
Well, in your novel, the girl falls in love with a woman when she becomes of age, and I guess that happened to you too.
Yes, it did. I think if you're brought up to believe that you are guided by God. You have tremendous confidence. How else could it be? You know, all the rest of the poor suckers having a terrible time and you're chosen. So when I fell in love with another woman, it didn't occur to me that there was anything odd about it. I simply did it.
When it became clear to the people around you that you were having a relationship with this other woman, did they try to exercise what they perceived as your demons?
Yes, it was particularly terrible. One day, we were simply brought up before the church and told, you know, that we were in terrible sin and that we'd have to split up, not see each other. And of course, I raged against this, so I had to be exorcised because they were convinced that I was possessed by demons. So this meant being locked up for 3 days, without food and without a light, so that I could get round to repenting.
And did you repent?
Of course. After 3 days in those conditions, you know, you'll say anything.
So what did you have to say when you repented?
I just allowed them to pray over me, and I said that I realised that what I'd done was wrong, though I hadn't realised at the time, and that I wouldn't do it again. But of course, you know, being intelligent, I began then to realise that there was something seriously wrong with this religion, and desperately uncompromising about it. And that started the whole thing falling away, because I thought, well, either I can go on living like this or I just have to leave this house and try and work out what's really going on. So I left.
You know, one of the things that really interested me in Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, your earlier novel, your semi-autobiographical novel, was that the mother and the mother's women friends in the novel really hate sex. And I mean, there's a scene where the mother hears a couple fornicating next door.
Yes.
So she sits down at the piano and starts playing her favorite hymn,
yes,
Yield Not to Temptation.
That's right.
And even, you know, the girl in the book gets the feeling that she was adopted because her mother didn't want to have sex in order to procreate. Do you think that the women's fear of sex and of heterosexual sex had something to do with their fear of lesbianism?
I think they just feared passion, feared feeling, full stop. It didn't matter whether it was heterosexual or not. I think my mother saw herself as a vessel purified by God, and she would have preferred if everybody else saw themselves that way. You know, it's a theme that's run through religion, the Christian religion anyway, almost since it started. You know, Christianity doesn't like pleasure. It's frightened of pleasure in any shape or form. And sexual pleasure is particularly anarchic, because it makes you look at yourself in a different way. It opens you up. A lot of people are afraid of sex for that reason.
How did you start writing?
Well, I didn't have any money at all. You know, I'd left Oxford and I didn't know what I was going to do, and I couldn't really get a job. So I started to tell a woman in a publishing company some stories about my rather bizarre life. She said, OK, if you can write it the way you tell it, I'll buy it. And this was a great challenge to me. So I rushed off and wrote the first draft, and she took it. And it really started from there. And it's been strange for me because I feel like somebody who was contracted to an arranged marriage and found themselves in love. You know, this is what I can do, and it's my sanity and my joy. So I'm really fortunate that I found it.
Do you think that your storytelling has been influenced at all by your early reading of the Bible or of your preaching when you were young?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I do have a very spare economic style, and I've learned that from the Bible. And if you think of the way the Bible's written, always in a very few words, in a few verses, you get the whole story. You know who the people are, you know where the place is, and something miraculous has happened. The Bible doesn't waste any time. It gets to the point and it uses words very precisely.
Let's talk about your new novel. Your new novel is called The Passion, and it's set in the early 1800s at the time of the Napoleonic Wars.
Yes.
I'd like for you to read the very opening of the novel.
It was Napoleon who had such a passion for chicken that he kept his chefs working around the clock. What a kitchen that was, with birds in every state of undress, some still cold and slung over hooks, some turning slowly on the spit, but most in wasted piles because the emperor was busy. Odd to be so governed by an appetite. It was my first commission. I started as a neck wringer, and before long I was the one who carried the platter through inches of mud to his tent. He liked me because I am short. I flatter myself. He did not dislike me. He liked no one except Josephine, and he liked her the way he liked chicken.
Why did you want to set your novel at the turn of the 1800s?
There were two reasons. One was that I got fascinated by the idea of Napoleon, because I heard on the radio how he went through his Egyptian campaign eating nothing but chicken, which he wrapped in brown paper. And I thought about this man and what it was that had excited a whole country to lose their lives and their livelihood for him for years and years. How had he done it? You know, what was his charisma? So I wanted to know about him. But I've always believed that setting things in the past allows you to enter into almost a fairy tale world where the constraints of the present are missing. It's like swimming, you know, that your usual sense of gravity is gone. You go somewhere different and you can learn lessons that would not be possible if you were there in your own home, in your own front room, reading about people who were contemporary with you.
And you do take advantage of that.
Yes, very much so. I do think that The Passion sets up a magical interlude where people have all kinds of choices and where they can read the story in all kinds of different ways because it's quite multi-layered. So you can read it as simply as a story, or you can go much deeper into it because really it's about obsession.
I want to quote a line from your book. In between fear and sex, passion is.
Mm-hmm.
Explain.
I think there's not really much to explain because it is summed up by that line. I think that passion is terrifying because you're in danger of losing yourself. And most of us really don't want to do that. We want to stay in control. And very often, the only thing that pushes us on, that allows us to make that leap and to say, OK, I'll go somewhere I've never been before with this person, is sexual desire. That's what acts as the catalyst. That's what makes us dare to do it. And that's why I said earlier that sex is so frightening, because if you do follow your heart's desire, you could end up anywhere.
One last thing. This is a really broad question, but what's the most interesting thing that you learned in the research that you did for your new book?
The most interesting thing?
Yeah.
I suppose what I always discover when I look at the lessons of history, which is that people don't change and they go on making the same mistakes very much in the same sort of way. And all we can do is look at that and laugh a little and forgive ourselves.
Well, Jeanette Winterson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jeanette Winterson's new novel, The Passion, is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, we'll have a couple of reports on the special Communist Party conference, which opened officially in Moscow today. Mikhail Gorbachev opened the conference with a call for the overhaul of the Soviet political structure. And among his recommendations, establishing an elective body of delegates who would serve no longer than 2 5-year terms, and this, of course, would be something new for the Soviet Union. They, in turn, would elect a governing body. Also tonight, our political correspondent Linda Wertheimer brings us up to date on the Veep race. Speculation has centered on members of Congress, but a couple of prominent people have taken their names out of the running for vice president today.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Over the past 14 years, Robert B. Parker has written 15 novels about a Boston detective named Spencer. The character became so popular, he even inspired the television series Spencer for Hire. Parker's latest novel is called Crimson Joy. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
I've read all of Robert B. Parker's Spencer novels, and I think he's getting tired of his own private eye. Spencer still quotes poetry and works out at a gym when he isn't running his miles along the Charles, and eats a lot, although not as much as his girlfriend, the feminist psychologist Susan Silverman. But being so tough and so sensitive at the same time seems to have wearied Spencer into a self-consciousness that's unbecoming, maybe even a little unctuous. I know it must be hard on him to have to listen to Susan say things like, "We are able to love one another with the intensity that we do because we are able to be separate while we are at the same time one." But it's equally hard on me when Spencer says to Susan, "I won't let you be alone with him. We worked too hard. It cost too much to be who we are, to risk it for professional ethics, or human compassion, or your sense of self, or all of them and world peace thrown in." The him Spencer doesn't want Susan to be alone with is one of her patients. a psychotic serial killer who seems to be killing his way up the economic and social scale, from hooker to waitress to exotic dancer to nightclub singer. All of the victims are black females on whose dead bodies the white killer, who may or may not be a cop, leaves a long-stemmed rose, because everybody in a Parker novel has to read romantic poetry, whether he wants to or not. When at last the killer is explained by his childhood and his extraordinary sexual fantasies, we are moved to a surprising pity, and so is Spencer, and this is Parker at his best. But it takes us a long time to get there, even in so short a novel, and the mechanics of the pursuit are perfunctory, as they were not, say, in Jonathan Kellerman's The Butcher's Theater, another novel about another serial killer, published a couple of months ago by Bantam. Partly this is because Kellerman evoked Jerusalem in a brilliant desert light, whereas Parker has so exhausted Boston that we might as well be in Dubuque. But Boston isn't the problem so much as Spencer is. From the beginning of the series, he was an unlikely graft of hunk and aesthete, of violence and daffodils. This gave the character some edge, as though he rubbed up energy and spin from his own internal contradictions. But Spencer generally relied in the crunch on his instincts. There was in his attitude toward the higher culture he was always quoting something smart-aleck, something Dennis the Menace, which was squarely in the tradition of the American private eye who learns more on the streets than he does in the library. Lately, however, those instincts have been numbed, and it isn't healthy. A real man, in the middle of a murder case, doesn't tell his endangered heroine, "You be Simone de Beauvoir, and I'll be Sartre, and we'll consider defining life by living." This isn't sticking to his crime-buster business. This is book chat. In a real world, the real Susan, full of scruples and sushi and warm Diet Coke, would be really and truly dead.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and as a columnist for New York Newsday, he reviewed Robert B. Parker's latest Spencer novel, Crimson Joy. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Next time I'll speak with writer Paul Monette. His new book, Borrowed Time, is a memoir about witnessing his lover die of AIDS. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the recordings of Hungarian pianist Annie Fischer. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will explain why the dictionary is in alphabetical order and the thesaurus isn't. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistance from Dan Cornwell. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.